All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again in the Big Brother 22 zone. Dom, I don't want to begin every single one of these podcasts just congratulating ourselves on still being here, but we made it. We made it all the way to week two.
Yeah, we cleared the very low bar of watching TV and then coming in here to start podcasting about it. Haven't even finished podcasting about it yet. No guarantee that's going to happen, but we are at least here in the room where it happens to get that done. So props to us on that so far, I suppose. But yeah, it is a relief to be back in here talking about Big Brother and being excited to do that, not just going through the motions for week one or doing like a cancellation draft, which may still be worth doing as it happens for this season. But you know, so much of our Big Brother related content, as and when that's happened over the past few years, has been at least semi-ironic. So it's nice to be here in here sincerely, enthusiastically embracing a season, even if some of the production choices so far leave something to be desired. But lots of time for all of that, I'm sure. I'm watching the live feeds again, something that I haven't done since I want to say 2012. So yeah, it feels good to be back after so long.
Let me ask you, as someone who has been watching the live feeds, as have I, where this first week or however many days it's been, I think today is like day 9 or 10 or something in the house at the time of this recording, where this last calendar week or so has stacked up for you in the grand scheme of Dom Harvey enjoying being a Big Brother fan?
Pretty high. And part of that might just be the novelty of getting to see week one feeds, which is not something we've really been accustomed to in the past. We've never had this level of detail from the first moment they walk into the house. We've just never had that view of what's going on. And the more I watch the feeds, the more I realize that the idea that seems to be propagated among a lot of Big Brother fans, and we have definitely been guilty of this in the past, the idea that because you watch a feed, you see everything and you know everything, that is complete bullshit. You know, there is we constantly find ourselves frustrated by, you know, we only get to see 2 or 3 or maybe 4 people, if we're lucky, talking at any one time. And there's so much going on. You know, 85% or whatever of the conversations in the house are just off limits to us. And ideally you get to see the important ones, and you see the big fights and blow-ups and so on, the big moments when they occur, but there is so much important game happening all the time that is just invisible completely. And so the idea that like that contrast that we always used to draw between Survivor as a show where we really know nothing, and knowing that you know nothing is the first step to analyzing the show properly, versus Big Brother, where in theory we are omniscient and we see everything, we know everything, and we can analyze it on that basis. That's really not true, and it never has been, and we are increasingly realizing now that it never will be.
I really have to applaud you, because I was sitting here optimistically trying to start the episode off with some positive kind of feedback on how the season has been going so far, and you somehow managed to weave that into the one thing you know is super triggering me so far this season. So mission accomplished there. Yeah, I'm totally with you that obviously, you know, having the live feeds is far, far, far better than anything we get when we're in here talking about Survivor, which is what we're for the most part covering on this podcast network. But yeah, it is a thorn in my paw. Am I using that correctly? It's not the end of the world, but it is at the very least a slight and very regular annoyance to me that with 16, for the most part, legendary people in here, so much going on game-wise, and also people just like getting to know each other. As you said, this is a relatively fresh thing, I think, for Big Brother fans, just getting to see feeds this early in the first place. And that by itself would be cool as well, to see all of the even non-game talk that is going on. But yeah, it has really stood out to me and really bothered me how, even with 4 cameras going, there are many, many times where they're only showing one conversation across all 4, or, you know, best case scenario, we are split between 2 different rooms. And when there are still 16 people in the house, I would imagine that means that at any given time, even when the lights are up, far more people are off camera than on camera. And so, like, when spoiler alert. Let me issue a spoiler alert for this podcast. I'm guessing most people hearing this will know this information by the time that we are able to release this. This is breaking news on Twitter at this current hour, but will not be by the time anyone else can hear this. We are going to be talking about things that have happened on the live feed. So if you don't want to hear about stuff that's going to air on, I guess, Sunday's episode, tune out now and come back whenever you have seen that. But we have breaking news here, Dom, that I promise will tie into what I was saying, which is Christmas has won the week two safety suite competition, used it on Ian, and just before we came in here to start recording, all of Big Brother Twitter was freaking out about, like, what in the world is going on? We haven't seen them have one conversation, and maybe it's possible that Christmas and Ian haven't really been talking that much in the house, and this is totally out of left field. But I would imagine it's just a situation where they were one of the majority of people who were just off camera at the time that pertinent things were happening. And that, I feel like, is so it's glaring to me, just because I'd really like to pin down why this bothers me so much. But when that is so obviously the case, I would think that people would err on the side of saying, obviously, we don't get to see everything, and this is not complete information, and don't take our word for any of this necessarily being 100% accounted for and accurate. But people seem to go so far the other direction and adamantly defend the idea that we see everything.
I think in Christmas's case, it may actually be she was having a conversation at Ian or towards Ian, which seems to be her mode of discussion. She just blathers on, and whoever's there, as long as they can just nod and smile and chime in every now and then, that is a successful conversation with Christmas. You've got her you've got her support nailed down. But I would believe that they actually really didn't have any meaningful interaction before now, and it was, for example, Franzel working over Christmas, getting her to save Ian, which again would be a conversation that we would love to see. That would be amazing to have access to, but we just don't get to see that. And I'm sure there are people out there who would love to have a 24/7 Janelle and Kesa cam, for instance. Or, you know, if you have a favorite, it's always frustrating when they kind of dip off the radar, like Tyler in most of the first week was nowhere to be found on the feeds. And so the question became, was he just laying low deliberately in the game, not trying to do anything there, or was he actually just, you know, like, what was actually going on with Tyler? And those are the terms that we have to ask that question in. But I've had a lot of fun watching the feeds, and the site that I use to watch the feeds, I don't know if this is just the site or the feeds itself, but when the feeds go down, they cut to these animal cams from a shelter, like kittens, bunnies, dogs, and so on. And normally that I would just be watching that anyway, that would be on in my background. So the fact that I'm actively wanting that to go away and to come back to the Big Brother house is really a sign of how strong this cast is and how much I want to see them, even if some people are saying the season is getting off to a rough start so far. So let's start there, unless you have anything to get into, because there was a lot of hype, excitement, confusion over premiere night, and the premiere itself, in terms of every single choice that production made, was a flop from start to finish. However, I think the excitement over just seeing these people back on Big Brother was enough to propel that to its conclusion regardless. We just about managed to stick the landing there.
I was genuinely ready for, just based on the first hour and a half of bad decisions by the producers, a night one eviction somehow being sprung on us at the very end. That was like the only thing I could come up with to make this worse and less exciting of a start.
And I almost felt like how bad the premiere was until that point made that more likely, because if you need to salvage it somehow, if you need to throw this twist in, which will be a note for the premiere to go out on, a night one eviction, even if it is tremendously unpopular among the entire fan base, as far as I can tell, that might be the way they talk themselves into doing that, just to salvage what was, from top to bottom, a catastrophic performance from them. But leaving all of that aside, we don't need to relive that misery necessarily. We end up with Cody as the first HOH of the season. And already, as soon as that happened, you started to hear the groans rising up from across North America, because Cody feels like the very obvious stereotypical week one HOH. And I don't think Cody really has a big contingent among the online fan base. Lots of people saying, okay, we saw Cody kind of let one season like ossify, and then BB18 we saw a bunch of Paulie, and then like this whole Derek Cody axis, which has been a cause for controversy over the past few days. Like, do we really need Derek and his lackeys just, like, masterminding another season and making this boring TV? So when Cody won and it seemed like this big alliance was automatically forming around him, it's like, okay, well, here we go again. And a lot of people would say that the nominations and the eviction for week one kind of bore that out. We target two of the obvious outsiders who, both in their own ways, seem like shadows of their former selves, and then we lose someone who was acclaimed as this legend of Big Brother, this icon, who we never thought we would get to see again, and then we got our hopes up for just enough to watch her walk out the door with her mask on again in the first week, and really not put up much of a fight and not seem to really enjoy the experience. But hey, if you get $40,000, whatever the minimum stipend is for coming in there, shading Dan Giesling on national TV, and then walking your way out the door, that's not bad. You take that.
I would, sign me up. I didn't realize this until now, sitting here looking at full transparency. I don't have actual notes here on week one. I'm just looking at the cast separated out by the teams that we drafted in our not really a cast preview podcast. I guess we did it after the premiere, but I'm just looking at this list of names, and now that I see the entire range of options here, I can't even come up with anyone who would be a clear number two behind what I feel is like the obvious number one answer for me of who I would have least wanted to see win the HOH week one.
Right. And looking at your team, you have Keisha at $3, right next to Kevin at $28.50, who,
trust me,
all three of us held up. And hey, I'm letting you kind of off the hook here. All three of us are guilty, and we all had Kevin as our winner pick. We were talking up his game. And so for the two of them to be up on the block together, obviously bad news for you in the first instance. But then also, I'm thinking, have I just been overhyping Kevin because of you? Like, you talked me into this. You brought me around on Kevin Campbell. Have I just been overrating this guy terribly for the past decade and change? When he seemed to be just like turning into this blubbering mess, and he wasn't really campaigning well and really was struggling socially, emotionally inside the house, it was like, okay, well, maybe $3 would have been too much to pay for Kevin at this point. But
I don't know about that. I feel good about obviously the 13-0 result, if nothing else, and what I saw from Kevin, even seeing his back up against the wall super early and him readily acknowledging in confessionals and potentially to other people in the house, like, this is my absolute worst nightmare. The number one thing I wanted to avoid was just don't be the first one. And that is going to be a super trying situation for any one of these people, I would imagine, to be on the block early on. We certainly saw Keisha handle it in such a way that perhaps left a bit to be desired, but at least as far as I was concerned, and maybe it was because he was up against someone where he felt good for the most part, and it wasn't as bad as it may have seemed on paper, I still feel like, from what I saw out of Kevin, I don't know what more I could have asked for. I feel like he maintained his composure and let people do whatever they wanted insofar as it involved keeping him safe. I'm sure we would have seen some scrambling if he had gotten some bad vibes along the way, and that probably made it easier. But I wanted to say, just job extraordinarily well done by Kevin in terms of handling being the week one nominee. I am not saying he necessarily knocked it out of the park in getting up to that point. And I am not thrilled to see that, like, Memphis wins the HOH, and I go on Twitter and see the live feed update that right away Ian and Kevin and Nicole Anthony are off in a room by themselves as, like, the clear kind of potential outsiders for this week. That is not something that excites me too much, but in general, compared to how I would imagine most people would handle being in Kevin's spot during week one, I thought he did a really good job.
I don't know where you come up with this stuff. I think you do this just to provoke me.
Oh my God.
And look, I get that you have to stick to your guns, and after being the biggest Kevin Stanville for the past decade, that it's hard to change tack now, but I feel like if he was up against anyone other than Keisha, really, like, against someone who actually showed any desire to stay in the house, was not doing an historically terrible job of campaigning to save themselves, I think Kevin would have had a much rougher time of it. And you saw these conversations happen in the first week. You saw people saying, okay, we understand on paper that Kevin is a bigger threat, you know, a big threat in his own right, definitely a bigger threat than Keisha, and yet he just seems like he has no fight left in him. And if that was all engineered by Kevin to give off this impression of weakness, okay, that's great if it works. I don't know if it leaves you in a great spot going ahead in the house where no one really wants to bring you in. But I don't think it was. I think that was sincere. I think he really was struggling with it. And with that in mind, I don't know how you not just defend Kevin's performance in week one, but like almost seem to be encouraging it and praising it, holding it up as an example, but whatever. Anyway.
I may be just completely blinded by the final result of the vote, but let me ask you this, Dom. First of all, I did not see probably nearly as much of the live feeds as a lot of people who are hearing this, and it sounds like potentially as much of the live feeds as you have, Dom. And instead of just acknowledging that, I am going to frame this as, over the course of this podcast, I'm going to throw out probably some fake news along the way. Dom, it is your job to jump in and correct me, and this may be the first instance of that happening. From what I'm merely saying, from what I saw, I thought Kevin was doing a reasonable job, but it sounds like it may have not at all been the case.
I will happily regurgitate whatever live feed updates my Twitter feed has kind of like got into my brain via osmosis, but I don't know if I'm a reliable narrator on any of this either, but I'll do my best to keep up that end of the bargain. But anyway, Cody will be our week one HOH, and I think Cody was never going to be in that much trouble regardless. And we've said before that if you think you are going to be having difficulties socially in the early stages of Big Brother, it can be very beneficial to win that week one HOH from that position of weakness, because now people have to come to you and they get used to the idea of working with you or you being a power. And if you can convince them that that's fine, that they're okay with it, then that's a good way to get your foot in the door before it slams shut after the first few weeks. Cody is the opposite. I think Cody was going to have no trouble, whether that's because of Cody's innate skill as a Big Brother player or the fact that he's like this charming athletic guy, and that by itself is a meal ticket in Big Brother, unless you really fuck up horribly, or as the fact that Cody and Derek were pre-gaming terribly hard and engineering this whole season from the outset, which more on that in a bit. Regardless of the reason why, I think Cody was always going to be in a good spot in this season, but because of that, I think there's an argument for winning that first HOH from a position of power where you get to consolidate that. And you know, if you want to run back the bomb squad, if you want to have this big crew develop around you, you can do that from the comfort and safety of the HOH room. You can be that fulcrum, that focal point where all of this comes together.
Where are you on the value in the year 2020 of being week one HOH?
I think it's high, and I've seen people saying that it's, in a way, it's harder to be the week two HOH than the week one HOH, where there's more room to kind of go out on a limb, where your nominations form this continuous narrative with the first HOH's nominations. And so it's easy to say, like, you know, let's say Memphis goes after people that Cody would have gone after. It's, oh, well, Cody must be working with Memphis, you know, that it's more of the same. And then if you don't do that, if you go against it, well, now you're drawing a line down the middle of the house and really exposing yourself, putting yourself out there. So you kind of get all of the downsides with none of the upside. I think Cody has pretty skillfully managed any of the potential downsides so far. And in general, I think there's a good argument in 2020 for winning that first HOH. And Cody is really proving why and doing that well. And it seemed like it was going to be rocky early on, because he wasn't really giving firm commitments to anyone in particular. He was just letting this general sense of Cody is in power and you should want to be with him form around the house. But because he had all of these different people in his orbit, it was easy for information to leak out. So we see Janelle and Kesa, who maybe would have been the week one nominees in another timeline, they know that they're in danger. They know that one of them, or as it turns out, both of them can play in the safety suite, win that, take themselves out of contention. And now it's effectively like Cody has had to nominate four people already. You have Janelle and Kesa, who kind of did a speed run of the Big Brother nomination safety process, but effectively knew their cards were marked, Cody was coming after them, and now also Cody has to choose two new people to go up instead. And let's say one of them had won the veto will come off, now you have a fifth person going up, and that is a whole third of the house that Cody's had to fire some shots at in this first week here.
It was like the original, remember the other, isn't his name Cody, that married Jess, who had to put up like five replacements one week?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great comparison anyway, but his name also is Cody, so it feels even more natural. But I guess Cody is used to this format from like Battle of the Block in BB 16, where you have these competing HOHs and sets of nominations and so on. But at the time, people commented that that almost served to consolidate the power in the house, where there were so many choices that had to be made that most of those choices would be in line with what the people in power wanted to happen. It was hard to really put yourself out there too much. And so for Cody, I think he sees a lot of value in just repeating that same formula up until the very last day, and then maybe me being more cutthroat with that final choice if it comes down to it. And honestly, I think that formula is likely to work for him. I think he's already off to a great start to run that back.
It crossed my mind, the idea of Derek essentially having to coach Cody on the exact thing he's been trying to talk Cody out of having done the first time for the last 4 years or whatever, 6 years at this point, I guess. Teaching Cody how to be more cutthroat while also not suggesting to Cody that perhaps this would have been a good idea the first time around.
Yeah, doing that while aggressively maintaining in public to anyone who will listen that, yeah, of course Victoria would have won anyway if Cody took her instead, so why not give that money to your best buddy, your old pal? But let's briefly segue into Derek then, now that he's coming up, because Derek's reputation has taken a battering within the first week and a half of this Big Brother season. A lot of people are alleging that BB16 was maybe the worst thing that happened to modern Big Brother, where the season itself, it was a clinically impressive performance by Derek in the mold of, let's say, Boston Rob on Redemption Island, where it's maybe not interesting TV, but you at least admire the technical skill on display. But then after the season, Derek has been gaining himself no friends with, apparently doing a lot of the pre-gaming for BB18, even though he wasn't on the season. A lot of his statements in between, him being a former cop and being very proud of that openly has not gone down well in the current climate. And then now the accusation is that he's doing his best to stick his fingers into BB22 as well, and to meddle with that. And I think the part of this is just people don't like Derek, so they will take an excuse to tear down Derek. But I wonder if the tipping point for this, as opposed to normal pre-gaming, is if you're on the season, fair enough. We understand there's going to be some pre-gaming involved, and it's going to be messy, and it's going to affect the outcome of the season in a way that maybe we don't like, or that taints its integrity. But for you to be doing this when you, Derek, supposedly chickened out from being on the season in the first place, or Nicole Franzel just executed you and Dan Giesing at the same time in what would be, I would say, one of the best moves of Big Brother history, regardless, then it's all well and good if you're on the season. Like, if Derek is in there with Cody, I expect Derek and Cody to be having some Zoom calls to iron out all the details beforehand. But if he's not even on the season,
Cody's going to meet you in person. I don't know if you saw the clip, but Cody's not too hung up on that.
Absolutely. But if it's not your circus, it's not your monkey. So back off, get out of the season, and stop just sticking your snout into yet another show in the franchise.
So, philosophy major Dom Harvey, why? What's so necessarily wrong about that?
I don't know. And this is one of the many controversial takes that I've been trying to put out there into the universe on Twitter this week. I don't get what the categorical difference is meant to be there. Firstly, because your favorite, Colin, and everyone else's, Janelle, if you want to talk about pre-gaming hard for All Stars and then all the other seasons that she's been on, to say nothing of Amazing Race and so on, this is just a staple of the franchise. This is something that happens all the time. Everyone here who has done their homework, maybe not if you're David and you've just kind of like effectively wandered in off the street and you wonder what all of this commotion is about. If you're anyone else in this house, you've been pre-gaming. You've been, whether kind of subtly, not so subtly, implicitly, explicitly, you've been going through the motions. You've been putting your ducks in a row for many weeks now in advance. And for a lot of people, the pre-gaming for Big Brother All-Stars began the moment they walked out of the house the first time. You know, a lot of these people have been in pre-gaming mode for the season for many, many years before it was even sure they were going to be on it. And you know how the Big Brother rumor mill works, and it's very easy for rumors to spread. Like Nicole Franzel was apoplectic that Janelle, an evil dick apparently, was spreading the rumors that she got Derek kicked off the season, and then that's what caused some of the tension between them in this one. So I don't think that this is a step above and beyond, and it's crossing a line. And if anything, if I wasn't on a season but I felt that I had some measure of influence, I would want to do everything I could to help out my friends who I knew for sure were going back in the house. To me, that would be a good measure of what friendship was in that context. As, oh, hey, we were buddies the entire season long. You took me to the end and lost $500,000 because of it. I'm actually going to do you a solid here. I will do what I can to say a good word about Cody to anyone who will listen. I think that's maybe the least Derek could do in the situation. So I get why people don't like Derek and are inclined to view everything he does with justified suspicion. I don't think this is one of those things. There are so many better reasons to dislike Derek that we don't need to hone in on a bad one.
Mm-hmm. And to bring in another couple of cops here that I think may make an apt parallel, like if Sarah Lucina were to go back on Survivor, I would be shocked if she was not regularly talking to Tony and Tony was not trying to make things go as well for her as possible.
Yeah, and you might not like it, but you understand that that is what's happening, and you as a player in this game, which here would be a returning player edition of Survivor, okay, that is not Survivor when it's 16, 18, 20 strangers and you're all going in blind, playing the game from first principles. It's a different game, but you have to know what game you're playing, and you can't just stamp your feet and insist with a tantrum that it should be the other game instead.
Yes. I want to ask you, sorry to jump back and forth here, but to return to Kevin quickly, we have certainly observed over the years and interviewed reality contestants who have said things kind of backing this up for sure. There is some sort of value in having something go at least slightly wrong kind of early to get you really woken up to the possible hiccups that may be in store for you down the line versus people who have it go just super smoothly, kind of get complacent, and it's very easy to then kind of lose focus and miss the warning signs and get totally blindsided. Even if you weren't super impressed by Kevin and his campaigning during week one, do you feel like I do, which is Kevin going through this will potentially at least benefit going forward and may, having survived the block, now be in a better position than if he had just not been nominated in the first place?
I think it certainly could, and maybe this is his baptism of fire in the Big Brother house, where in BB11, he was not nominated until, I want to say, week 7, week 8, somewhere in that range, and so he had a full 2 months to get acclimatized to just being able to sit back and watch all the drama unfolding before him without being enmeshed in it himself. Now he is thrown in at the deep end, and he's having to really adjust to that from the outset. If he does, though, he might think that, okay, I've seen what the worst of this experience can be, and so now I can recover from that and move on and be stronger, and I can ease into playing the game that I want to play if I have enough time to do that. And we do know that there is this trend of whoever survives that that week one nomination and eviction often makes a very deep run in the game because the attention kind of is off them. And I don't know whether it's because it's just assumed that, oh, hey, we kept them for a good reason, right? You know, they had enough time to show that vulnerability on the block that maybe endears them towards people. I don't know. But I could see Kevin definitely going into that trend. It might be a little awkward this week now with Ian being out of commission, where one of Memphis's most likely targets for nominations could be Kevin. If he wants like an easy pawn, I could see him also being like the Spencer Clawson of the season, where every time you need someone to put up, well, hey, Kevin's sitting right there. Let's just nominate Kevin.
First of all, props on the out of commission joke. And I was going to say exactly Spencer is the concern I have, is this can go hard the other way and Kevin's on the block 6 weeks in a row.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is it could be one thing or it could be the exact opposite thing. And really, that's the extent of my analysis.
Okay, strong. Yeah, I am maybe just blinded by optimism here, but Kevin does strike me as the type who is potentially going to have some sort of benefits from having survived that kind of position in week one, but certainly remains to be seen. And as you said, now with, you know, happy to see, obviously, Ian B. Locke safe this week, but it does probably mean worse news for Kevin than if that competition had fallen into the wrong hands. My final question on Kevin, I guess, is, as you have referenced in our auction draft, he was the most expensive item by quite a wide margin. He and Ian were very much above the rest of the pack, I think largely for sentimental reasons in both cases, but in both cases, what do you think would be like a fair price on Kevin right now, given about $150 total prize pool? Do you still think he would be above average even?
I don't think so. I think he'd be like maybe high single digits.
Okay. I would love to disagree with you, but unfortunately I do probably have to kind of take your word for it and disregard my brain telling me that Kevin is just flawless, because that's how I felt for a decade.
Absolutely. So our nominations here in week one are going to be Keisha and Kesa, but they could have been, oh sorry, Keisha and Kevin, they could have been Janelle and Kesa, but the safety suite, the newest twist installed into the Big Brother game, allowed them to save themselves. And is this what we've been waiting for the whole time? Is this the rare unicorn of a good Big Brother twist?
It is certainly off to a good start, at the very least, as far as I am concerned. As I tweeted, and people love it when I repeat my tweets on air, so I'm going to do it. The only upside to 2020 becoming complete just bizarro world is the twists on Big Brother actually seem like they might be good now. I know I was not alone in noticing this, and I'm guessing this crossed your mind as well. This safety suite functions a lot like the way immunity works on The Genius, the Token of Life, where one person wins the main match and gets to give immunity to one other person, and then everyone else is up for grabs. I am a big fan of the safety suite so far.
Yeah, I love it. And depending on how unexpected your choice of who to give that Token of Life, we'll call it, to, That can stir up a lot of drama. So this week, everything coming up, Ian Terry, where it seems like he would have been Memphis's target, at least for a backdoor, and Memphis winning is the worst thing that could have happened to Ian. And then suddenly Christmas, of all people, wins it, takes him off, and he gets the ceremonial punishment. But that's what he wants anyway. He would gladly volunteer to take on the punishment. So this is the best outcome that possibly could have happened to Ian after Memphis wins HOH.
I'm going to say, at least on these podcast airwaves, Token of Life is canon. That is what it is called when you are gifted the immunity from whoever won.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right. But yeah, I am a big fan of the safety suite in general, and was also just a big fan of the result in seeing that Kacer and Janelle, two of the people I was most excited to see back from like a Big Brother super fan, which I guess kind of has been in air quotes over these last couple of years, but certainly applied back in the day from that perspective. What did you think about the way this worked? I don't know what they necessarily knew as far as the intricacies of the rules, but one of the more puzzling things to me from week one was both Kacer and Janelle choosing to play in this competition.
Yeah, it sounds like their assumption was it's not like if only one person plays, then they win by default, because that would make for bad TV. They would still have to compete, and there's a chance that they would fail, you know, if they just didn't do the task in the allotted time or however it might work. And so you do actually need people in there to guarantee that it happens. And maybe even with that information, you'd still rather have only one of Kesa or Janelle in there so that the other one could play this week instead. With the benefit of hindsight, it sounds like Kesa and Janelle somehow are off the radar entirely for Memphis this week. So let's touch on that briefly here, because I remember Dr. Will being incredulous back in All-Stars that Janelle by herself was a bigger target than Chilltown, a bigger target than, you know, Danielle and James, who are known to be a pair, really a bigger target than any other permutation of people in the house combined for most of her stay in the house. And now that Kesa, her old partner in crime, is back in there too, that is the ideal target, the ideal enemy to rally your own side against if you are anyone in that big supermajority. So I wonder if we're going to see that become a recurring theme where people will always find reasons not to put up Janelle and Kesa, but in the same breath and the same conversation that they're doing that, they'll be saying to their allies, okay, we need all hands on deck. We need to keep this alliance together so that we can beat Janelle and Kesa.
Yes, and I would say, as much as I wish this were not the case, based on what I saw, again, please do correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me like both Kesa and Janelle are more or less in there playing the exact same game they played together in BB6 and BB7 and are potentially making it easy for people to put the spotlight off and on them at their leisure. If they want to give them a week off, I think that's totally understandable, like such as this week Memphis potentially seems uninterested in putting them up. I think it makes a ton of sense, frankly, that Janelle and Kesa are left in for a little while, just given how easy it seems like it's going to be to get them up later.
That's been a fascinating dynamic so far, where you had Kesa on day three saying, okay, this is war, you know, we need to make it our side against them, and you're either with me or you're against me. And
with Janelle, who's his side? What's his side?
Well, that's the thing. He didn't quite make it that far. I think he's been counting optimistically in terms of who might be with him and who's against him. But I think he is so hardwired into that mode that it's hard to imagine him playing in any other way at this point. And ditto for Janelle, who she has never been in a game of Big Brother where her back has not been up against the wall. You know, we saw BB14 where maybe that seemed like it was going to be possible for some amount of the time. The moment the coaches enter the game, all right, Janelle is out, and you know, BB6, BB7, she was under the gun from start to finish. So Janelle has never experienced a game of Big Brother where she is not the center of attention and the primary target. And so if that ever is true this season, I think she won't know how to handle it. And I think she'll handle it badly enough that she'll then become the target again because she's kind of drawing attention to herself. But the two of them, Janelle and Kesa, had a really interesting conversation earlier this week where Kesa was saying, what would we do if we won HOH? And Kesa, as is his style, had this elaborate 5-point plan to, okay, we're going to target like David, or you know, we're going to pick off some of the people from that big alliance, but not the people at the center. So then we're going to make the people who are really in charge fight each other over which of these peripheral people to keep. And Janelle had to sit him down and say, look, Kesa, you did exactly the same thing in All Stars and it didn't work. It got all of us burned in the end. You know, it kicked James out of our alliance, who was frustrated by us just not making the obvious right move. And you can't just be doing this again. You have to be more adaptable. And if you know, if Janelle is telling you that you have to be flexible in the game of Big Brother, then something has gone wrong. But honestly, for as much as Kesa seems to be one of the just like smartest and most insightful people to step foot in the house in a long time, and for as much as I know he has this incredibly devoted following, and I would say for good reason, more so than most of the other fan favorites in Big Brother history, he's not a good Big Brother player. And I think his actions in this third, or I guess we can call it a fourth time if you're so inclined, I think those only reinforce and confirm that so far.
Yes, but I will say, despite being a little let down at the very least about their performance over the course of week one, just merely seeing Janelle and Kesa back in the Big Brother house is continues to be mind-blowing to me. It still doesn't even feel real that these two are back. I never, ever, ever thought that would happen.
Yeah, and Kesa has never spent a day in the Big Brother house without Janelle. And, you know, the season that Janelle spent without Kesa, it seemed like she was never really enjoying it and never found her feet. So maybe, despite their differing personalities, despite the fact that they haven't really kept up, as far as I understand, since they were on Big Brother together, maybe that dynamic is what they need just to keep both of them sane through these early weeks.
So call your shot now. Next week, potentially, we roll around. I don't know how likely this is or what it would need to take to happen, but whenever down the line, Janelle and Kacer are the Thursday night nominees against each other, who do you think is leaving first?
I think Janelle will be the bigger target, but then that might turn into a leveling war where, because Janelle is such a big target, it makes sense to keep her for next week so that she and, let's say, Nicole Franzel will keep going after each other, or Janelle and Danny, or whatever it is. Whereas Kesa seems like, you know, he'll play his way out of the house if given the opportunity, but he's not going to have that opportunity, so maybe he's safe. You know, he's fairly tame by comparison. And what's interesting about this, I think, is that in theory, the two of them are great allies to have, because they will always be bigger targets than you. They can win competitions on behalf of your alliance, and Janelle, historically, can win more competitions than basically anybody except Danny, who is also in the house with her this season. And then also, they're not great Big Brother players, so if you need to hoodwink them, then you can. If you need to come up with some elaborate scheme to fool Kesa, you can probably do that too. And so, you know, you won't beat them in the end, probably. I don't know. And then also, to the extent that there's production interference of some kind, or any involvement by America, that is a guarantee that will be on your side as well. So, in theory, you cannot draw it up better than, in terms of alliances than having Janelle and Kesa. But after this week one, where they are already so ostracized from the house, just making any like public overtures in their direction gets you cast out of the big alliance, and now all your eggs are in that one basket, and that's not where you want to be.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think in terms of if the two of them are on the block together, anytime before the prospect of Janelle potentially like running the table in competitions becomes slightly realistic, I think I probably agree. I think this was roughly your conclusion, that Janelle is going to be viewed as the bigger threat between the two. But I also think, you know, as we saw in the original Big Brother All-Stars, many people in this house may recognize the value in leaving such a glaring threat in the house. And if Janelle is on the block against basically anyone, and they're kind of on the outs with the rest of the house, and I have to wonder, okay, whichever one I leave, I need to now worry about potentially kind of fading into the background and getting on people's good sides over time and not making a big scene out of themselves, it's almost always not going to be Janelle who I am worried about having that kind of effect if she is allowed to stay. So I do think, honestly, Kacer would be the boot there for a couple of different reasons.
Yeah, and the Janelle army is already out in force, just wishing that she could be on the feeds constantly, dragging Nicole Franzel for, you know, having this Janelle-icy, as has been known for going on 15 years now. And almost actively rooting for production rigging to just advance Janelle in the game if she ever seems like she's in any danger. So it's interesting seeing like the new school stands versus the old school stands, like the new school stands who were, you know, in diapers when Janelle was playing Big Brother the first time in her prime, versus the old school stands who have loved Janelle for 15 years and show no signs of slowing down anytime soon. I wonder if those two camps are going to collide at some point, and just how messy that's going to get. Janelle, I find it fascinating and ironic in a way that one of the recurring criticisms of Nicole Franzel is that she hates other women, that she won't support other women or work with other women, because the person in the history of Big Brother that is most sure of is Janelle Piazzina. That has been a recurring dynamic across all three of her seasons. And I'm sure if you asked the Janelle fans, they would attribute that to just rampant Janelle-icy, you know? How can she be expected to work with them when they're also just they're so pressed over her very existence? But I think there's something to that. But also, the way that she carries herself, maybe that's changed now. Maybe she's mellowed out a bit at 40 versus 25. But back in the day, if as a wise man, I think, once said, blondes hate other blondes. And if there's anyone who was going to prove that very trite maxim true, Janelle was doing her best to.
Mm-hmm. All right. So definitely going to be really curious to see what kind of role Kacer and Janelle continue to play in this house. Because as far as I have seen so far, and I will grant that, you know, we're only like 36 hours, 48 hours close to into Memphis's HOH here. It seems to me like Janelle and Kacer are out of the spotlight this week, at least compared to last week. So going to be interesting to see how that develops and when the kind of tipping point comes for when the rest of the house seems to view them as a bigger priority than they currently do. But Dom, I'm looking at your draft team here. You came away with four people. We talked about Cody. We've talked a little about Memphis. You also got Nicole Franzel and Tyler. Did Derek draft this team for you? And what do you think about this big alliance that we've seen now coming together of all of your team and a couple other people?
Derek's tendrils truly are everywhere. They reach so far down. Even up across the border here, just manipulating my draft board.
There are people who are going to not realize that you aren't in England anymore, who are going to be so confused about like the geography on that comment.
Sure. I mean, hey, I'm sure Derek's influence extends across the Atlantic as well. But I honestly love my draft team, and it was interesting watching the rise and fall and then kind of rise and kind of fall again of Memphis over the past week and a bit, where he is the current HOH and there is so much room for that to develop. But initially when Memphis first arrived on the scene, it was like, who is this guy? Like, if you didn't tell me it was Memphis, you didn't tell me this was a former Big Brother player, I would never have told you in a million years that that was Memphis. He looked and even sounded mostly very different. And I was excited to see what this new daddy Memphis could get up to, whether he would have changed and mellowed out a bit, if he was still a womanizer, as Jerry called him, if he'd settled into a career yet, or if he was still partying it up. And I really took a shine to old man Memphis in the first week, who would, you know, get up early every day to like clean the house because all these young'uns were leaving their dishes out. And honestly, like, if you want to get on Memphis's good side, which would have been a great move ahead of him winning this week 2 HOH, just getting up at like 7:30 and doing some dishes would be a great way to endear yourself to him. And people were even saying that in the house this week, that okay, well, I guess everyone in the house is waking up on Memphis's hours now, because that, you know, that's just how this has to work. But it seemed like he was in a great spot early on, but that has kind of slid this week because maybe some of that HOH power is going to his head. And then also, he's not doing a great job of like containing his anger or disdain for people. Like, that's really shining through. And then also just in general with the way he's approaching the game, he was really doing a lot of work to organize this big alliance, but not really with himself in it to any real degree. So he was getting the, okay, like, let's have Cody and Danny and Nicole Franzel and, you know, Bay and Daya over here, and yeah, maybe Tyler's cool as well. You know, we'll get this big group together. But then Memphis never really did the work to really cement himself in that. It was more like he would just mention the idea of this alliance existing to the people in it and think that that was enough. And so he's now kind of on the outside looking in with that. And the same is true in a way of Tyler, who I think was coming out of his first season. He knew the people, if they had done any homework at all or had just watched a show in the past few years, they would be onto his game, and they would know what he's capable of doing. And he did not want to overextend himself in that first week and get caught out. And as a result, he also was not really too much involved in those early conversations that helped to bring the Cody block together. And so now, even though a lot of people individually in the Cody block really love Tyler and want to work with him, and you can already get this Andy-esque montage together of everyone saying, I feel great with Tyler, I want to go to the final two with Tyler, he's not at the heart of that block, which I think actually is going to work to his advantage and maybe to Memphis's too, because you already see the cracks showing in that block. You already have a lot of personal feuds, a lot of the more capable social players in that group kind of going after each other and making sure that they have their own parachute and then trying to cut off the options that the other people have. And if and when that implodes, then if Tyler is at the center of it, then it's going to be, okay, well, look, there's just Tyler back on his bullshit. and maybe Memphis too. Whereas now, if Tyler kind of escapes that fallout, then it's going to be back to, oh, Tyler's just like this poor wounded bird who he's just so sad. You know, 2 months into the game, that Casey's not there, and he's never been able to get it together. Which shockingly seems to be what people sincerely think about him so far in this season. So I actually think he's in the ideal spot for now. Of he's going to be safe almost no matter what. I think anyone who wins HOH is going to have bigger priorities than Tyler, but he's in good enough with enough people that he can make something work almost regardless of any twist that the game takes in the near future.
Yeah, I did not see Tyler's original season, but I came in here expecting him to be one of the bigger targets, and he went in our draft for $7.50 to win 150, so only needs 5% win equity to break that bet even right now. And I, as far as I'm concerned, he seems like one of the front runners to be the steal of the draft here. I don't know, obviously, everything that's been going on in the house, but I agree with your call that pretty much no matter who wins HOH next week, I would not at this point be expecting Tyler to be a priority, even for nomination, let alone for eviction. And I also really agreed with what you said about being solidly in with kind of the core group right now, but not the absolute center of it. I think potentially being even better than being at the absolute center of the big day one alliance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, definitely liked what I have seen out of Tyler so far, other than the part where he went around making multiple final twos in the span of like 20 minutes. And I was thinking, okay, here's the Tyler I've been hearing about, working the social strategic angle, building people's confidence in him, really trying to get tight bonds developed early on. And then we see in the TV episode him talk about like, yeah, that was totally accidental. I don't know how that happened. I didn't mean to do that.
He's so good that he's playing like the BB20 Tyler game accidentally, even when he's trying to mix it up.
He cannot stop. What do you think about the final member of your team to this point, Nicole Franzel?
Okay, so I know that people don't like Nicole Franzel, and I can understand why, and you're perfectly and you're perfectly entitled to not like her. However, that does not mean that she's playing a bad game, because so far she's playing a great game. And even though the Janellacy is shining through and jumping out, and you know, Janella's aware of it, everyone in the house is aware of it, and I'm sure they will use it to their advantage. In terms of just automatically being at the solid center of everything that's going on socially, Nicole is there. And already, the reports are that she was the one who worked her magic on Christmas to get her to save Ian completely out of the blue. And maybe that will get traced back to her, because it would make a lot of sense for Nicole to be protecting Ian. But it really seems like Nicole already is just there, and you can't get rid of her. And you kind of don't really understand why people trust her so much or want to work with her, because a lot of them don't even seem to like her that much. It's like, I don't know if Danny really truly likes Nicole, but they seem to be bulletproof in the game together. I don't know how close Cody and Nicole actually are, or, you know, Nicole and whoever else, but Nicole is just there. She's doing good work. And, you know, if I'm drafting the players that I most am rooting for, I don't think Nicole will be on the list. Even though I think she is massively overhated, and a lot of that is just like rabid Janelle fans doing their thing. This pre-existed BB22, you know, BB16, BB18, people didn't like her either, so fair enough there. But I think the hate for Nicole is like so rabid that it just blinds people to how effective she is at the game of Big Brother. And I was kind of hoping that would be in effect in our draft, where, you know, if you weren't avidly following BB18, it's easy to overlook how effective she was as a player. If you know, and you guys both did, and you made me pay top dollar for her, then you know just how lethal she can be, and I have no regrets at all about taking her so far.
Yes, Nicole, I guess Memphis was 1150, but Nicole was the only other person besides Kevin, Ian, and Memphis to go over $10 in that. She went for $16 in that draft, and I agree with you. I am not personally like a diehard Nicole stan or whatever, but I have certainly observed roughly the things it sounds like you have observed over the years. And I have always been puzzled by the seemingly like rabid hatred from at least some percentage of the fan base towards Nicole Franzl. I assumed I was just missing something, and it still is very possible that I am, and there's a completely valid reason that everyone in certain corners totally despises her. But I feel a lot about Nicole just in the context of as a Big Brother player as I do about Cody, which is these are not necessarily or just explicitly not my favorite players in the house, but at the same time they can clearly do an effective job and have a lot of success within this game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think in terms of Cody? I meant to ask this earlier, and now that Cody's come back up, it seems fine to circle back. Has Cody stood out as noticeably improved to you?
I don't know. I think he, it's not so much that he's improved a lot, but I think he is testing his ability to play the game without Derek there to rein him in. It was often said about Cody in BB 16 that he would often say, I'm going to confront someone. I'm going to go off on someone. I'm going to do this big move that's going to upend the entire game. And then Derek would take him aside and whisper in his ear, and any hope of that would be extinguished. And that was part of what made BB 16 so frustrating to watch for people, was that, you know, Cody would talk the talk but never walk the walk. And that was to his credit as a player, I suppose, that he never actually followed through on that. But the question was going to be, can he hold it together? And especially, can he hold it together from the top in the Derek position without Derek there to be the guide for him? And so far, the answer seems to be yes. But he is juggling a lot of balls right now. And if he's ever sloppy about that, then I could see all of that kind of crashing down suddenly. He might become the Paulie of this season, where it seems like for the first few weeks, he's just coasting to an easy win. And then, like, one thing changes, one pin comes out, and then it's game over.
Yeah, I was, I think, more of a believer in Cody as BB 16 was happening, and then obviously came quite a bit down on him once that final decision was, you know, inked into the historical record. And Cody kind of demonstrated himself to perhaps not be the strongest tactical mind that I had at least thought was within the realm of possibility as BB 16 was going on. But this time around, I can't cite specific instances of great moves that I've seen by Cody, but I thought he did a reasonable enough job. He was someone that I got to see quite a bit of on the live feeds during the first week, obviously, because he was head of household. And there were only a couple times that I found myself saying, oh my God, Cody, what are you doing? And based on my expectations, I would consider that a big win.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's talk through a couple of the other people here in this kind of majority alliance that we saw form in week one, and I would imagine continue through week two here now with Memphis running it back for them in charge the second time around. We have Enzo, ends up being our week one Power of Veto winner, competition beast Enzo. Dom, what did you think of Enzo now a decade later?
I'm loving this new and improved Enzo, although I say all of this with the caveat that if we did our cancellation draft for this season, I think Enzo would be a first round pick. I think if anyone is going to have the show issuing a formal apology, it's probably going to be Enzo.
He's literally on the feeds talking about, like, he starts saying something, then comments about how, no, I can't say that, I'm going to get canceled by Twitter, and then starts saying it, and they just cut the feeds.
Even when he knows he shouldn't say things, he just does it anyway. Like, his way of ingratiating himself with Danny, who seems to be a solid Alliance member for him at this point, is to talk openly and brazenly about how much he loves Evil Dick, which is like, if ever there was a failure to read the room, there it is.
Yes.
But I'm liking this new Enzo, and I'm glad for him that he's finally been able to win a competition. And Enzo just is, he's just great TV. Like, he tells these stories where the stories themselves are not really at all interesting whatsoever, but just the way he tells them is so good. Like, there's a clip of him talking about his days as a crayon salesman, and like everyone in the room is just creasing up laughing, and the story itself is like totally mundane, but just he's so good at, for whatever reason, Enzo is just so funny when he's talking about it that you can't help yourself from laughing along. And I hope we get to see that side of Enzo all season. And so far, there's a case to be made for Enzo being in the best position in this Big Brother house, where like Cody and Enzo are like super tight. He has these one-on-one connections with a lot of different people. He's in one of these like five different permutations of that super alliance. But I don't think anyone sees Enzo as this like pressing threat that they have to get out. Right now, he's just, he's the laughter of the house. And as always, I think that is so underrated in these social games where there's so much downtime. People, you just want people to enjoy being around you. And this is the other end of what, I can't remember who it was. It may have been Danny was saying to Kevin in advising him how to secure the votes for himself in the first week, which is like, if you are just moping around and being grumpy, like that just brings the mood down. No one wants to be around that. You have to be the kind of just like witty, smart, fun, funny person that you are. And people will warm to that. I want to keep you around. And Enzo is passing that test with flying colors.
I totally agree with that. I have been very impressed with, other than, you know, the off-color stuff that he doesn't seem to be able to prevent himself from saying. And frankly, that kind of thing may ingratiate him with the people that are actually in there in the house having to, you know, that he has to entertain over the course of this summer. I feel pretty similarly about Enzo's spot as I do when we were talking about Tyler, where like being on certainly the ins with the big group but not at the absolute center of it is often a very, very premium place to find oneself early in a season of Big Brother. At this point, I would have a little more faith in Tyler to convert from that spot than Enzo, and it kind of ties into a concern I have for Enzo, and I imagine this is a concern he has for himself, which is I have total confidence in Enzo being able to get in well enough socially to get by for the early weeks a huge percentage of the time, and probably most of the middle weeks as well. My concern for Enzo would be falling into essentially the same thing that happened to him the first time, where yeah, he is in a great spot to go deep, but in a poor position to actually be able to convert the win unless he is controlling the competitions near the end of the game, which maybe, you know, is in the realm of possibility. He's certainly done well enough to this point compared to everyone else in the house for the most part. But I wonder how much of a concern that is going to be for Enzo in there. Like, I would guess on day one, he would be saying that is above all what I definitely don't want to see happen. But it seems at least possible to me like he may be going exactly back into that same kind of path.
I raised that concern in our draft. That was part of why I didn't want to pick him. But I'm kind of a bit more optimistic now. I think he might actually be able to pull that off. Although, having said that, early weeks, only week two, you know, yada, yada, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I do want to say, while I am concerned about that potentially happening to him again, I definitely think it is well within Enzo's range for us to show up 8 weeks from now or whatever and have him giving confessionals about, like, yeah, it's been fun so far, but now the gloves are coming off and I am mm-hmm. not here to come in third again.
Yeah, and it seems like the alliance that he is really at the core of is himself, Cody, Enzo, and Danny. And those are four of the best social players in the house, just in terms of making connections and then using those connections to their advantage. So this is kind of like, it's a government of all the talents. You have all these great players under the same roof working together. And that really is formidable. And, you know, maybe Tyler's going to be in the mix too. And there's some stiff competition in the house. But I love his spot. I love the people that he's working with. So I think everything's looking out for Enzo.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up Danielle Donato, because she may be the person I have the most unanswered questions about where she stands in the game right now. Would you say anyone would be coming after Danielle?
No, I think Danielle is safe.
Okay, and it does seem like, despite not being explicitly someone who I at least has been flagged up as in that, at least as far as I was concerned, I thought it was Cody, Memphis, Nicole, Tyler, Enzo, and Christmas as like the core six that I've been thinking of. But it sounds like Danielle is in quite well with them, to say the least.
Yeah, there are so many combinations that it's hard to pin down exactly which one is the real one, if that makes sense to ask. And it's already starting to leak out a bit. So Danny apparently, like, name-dropped Enzo as being in one of these many sub-alliances, which he wasn't meant to be in. And then, so, like, if you're perceptive enough to pick up on that and then, like, follow the trail back, maybe that gets you somewhere. Right now, yeah, it seems like it's Danny, Enzo, Cody, and Nicole. But then I can come in here and say, you know, maybe Enzo is playing the best game in the house. Maybe Cody is. Maybe Tyler is. Honestly, maybe Danny is. Like, there's a very good case for Danny, too.
I was just going to ask. It sounds to me like Danny may be in a spot where winning head of household could be a net negative. She's forced to show her cards anytime soon, but we certainly know Danielle is one of the all-time great Big Brother competitors. Are you know, having already talked about the value of some of these early week heads of household opportunities, am I wrong, do you think, for suggesting that Danny may want to just hang back at this point?
I think it could work for her to win and run like a quiet HOH week, but I definitely see where you're coming from. I think Danny, her biggest problem is she wants to play the game with people she likes, and this is what kind of doomed her in BB8, which we are rewatching for our Patreon series, which you can find at patreon.com/DomandColin, and also in BB13, where she was in a crushing position in that game, like absolutely dominant position, and then brought it all crashing down because she would rather spend time with Dom and put up a fight for him, not see him get evicted, than to keep working with the likes of Rachel Riley and so on. And I worry that that is just like a fundamental part of her personality and therefore of her gameplay, and that it's hard for her to hide that. That being said, she kind of balances her range strangely well, where the fact that she always seems to have this kind of like ambient disdain for whoever she's talking to, like this vaguely like cool girl, mean girl kind of thing, although she would bristle at the term mean girl from what I hear. The fact that she gives off that kind of vibe means if she doesn't like you, it maybe isn't as overt because she's like that even with the people that she does like at times. So maybe that's a bit overblown. But I think if there's anyone who in that big group who like could just completely tank their own game for no good reason, then we've seen Danny do that before. So I would say it was her.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up her husband now, Dom. I would say, based on my limited exposure to Big Brother 22 Twitter thus far, Dominic, one of the big winners. I feel like I've seen a lot of very good tweets coming from Dom.
Yeah, successful wife guy performance so far, crushing it, and have faith that he'll continue that for the rest of the season.
Yes, of course, the number two Dom in the history of reality TV behind Dominic Abate. No word yet, Dom Harvey, on where you're going to stack up there.
I'm lucky just to make it onto the podium.
I don't recall saying you were on the podium.
Sure.
All right. I said I had a ton of unanswered questions about Danielle and her just kind of position in the game, and I'm now struggling to come up with exactly what those kind of questions are. I get the sense, and it sounds like you are more or less confirming for me, that it seems like she's just kind of playing a relatively solid interact with basically everyone in the house, but not really go out of my way to set too much in stone right away kind of game. And that is what I would be hoping to see out of someone like Danny among this cast. I will say, just because when I thought of this idea, Danny was one of the names that came to mind to me. Dom, we talked in some recent podcast about what a tragedy it is that the Hinkie vote on Big Brother seems to have like gone the way of the dodo, where it used to be kind of fashionable, but then it became overdone, and now no one really does the Hinkie vote anymore. I thought last night was potentially a really good opportunity, when the whole house expects it to go 13-1, for someone like a Danny or an Ian or a Davon kind of inconspicuous type to throw that Hinkie vote in there. What do you think about that? Am I just imagining some weird fan fiction that would have been meaningless?
No, I would have loved it, but sadly I did not come to fruition there. But going down your roster of blondes who may or may not hate each other, as blondes are supposedly want to do, we've just talked about Danielle, we've talked about Janelle at some length. Let's touch on Keisha, who is going to be our first evictee from Big Brother All-Stars 2020. And there was a lot of disappointment over seeing this week ending with Keisha going, people saying like of course, you know, we wait all this time for Keisha to come back. Not everything is going to happen. Finally, it does. And then she's gone week one and seems like she never got into the experience at all. And in a way, I'm surprised that people are surprised, not just because it has been so long since BB10 that, you know, I think like late 20s, early 30s versus in your 40s, it's just a very different vibe for a lot of people. Like, it's very unlikely that someone is going to have the same personality, unless it's like Harry or whatever. Like, yeah, people change over the course of that time frame in their lives. And so no real surprise to see Keisha do that. The second thing, and this isn't even a point about Keisha, it's just about the structure of the show Big Brother, is that we have never really had these week one feeds before. So often someone goes out week one and we don't really know if they were putting up a good fight to save themselves, because a lot of that work is already settled by the time the feeds come on. And I think there are lots of people who were the first boots who could have had an iconic legacy like Keisha if they had made it that far in that season. Like, maybe we see Carol Journey throwing hands with Evil Dick in BB8 if she's saved in week one or whatever. But yeah, a lot of names who are like lost to history because they go out early, who just never got the chance to make a name for themselves. And often, even the people who are all-stars, who have earned their spot on the season, like most people would say Keisha had, they're not earning that in week one. You know, they don't have... you go back to week one of BB10, it's like, okay, yeah, Keisha was having some problems with some people and making herself known early, but not to the extent that she was about to go on to do by any means. And then it's also worth remembering that a lot of what we remember as these big iconic moments, or these things that players did, they were collective efforts. Like Keisha's birthday, that was not a solo performance. That was an ensemble effort where it's not just Keisha's birthday is going bad and she's mad about it. It's Keisha is in a house with Jerry and Rennie and April and Jesse and Lima and all of these, and even Memphis to some degree, all of these incredibly combustible personalities, and them all being crammed in that same tinderbox together is what gives rise to an amazing moment like that. And the vibe in this house is just different. So even if you had BB10 Keisha transplanted into the present day in this house for a much greater length of time, I don't think you would see anything like you saw on BB10, because the supporting cast just isn't there to help out with it. So
the Keisha's birthday thing was like a Rube Goldberg machine of arguments.
Yeah, it was like four different unrelated arguments that there was no reason they should have collided the way they did. And yet somehow there was the perfect storm all came together to make it work. So obviously sad to see Keisha go early on, but in an all-star cast, if you are not sad to see people go, even if you dislike them, you know, just the potential that they had, then something has gone wrong. And I was not expecting to see that much more from Keisha. And it's like Carl's used to say about Enzo, I like the idea of Keisha more than I like the reality of Keisha, I think. And that's, you know, so I don't think this is any great loss, but I know there are lots of people out there who will strongly, vehemently disagree.
Yeah, I would say there were very few people I would have been happy to see leave week one. And as far as I could tell, all of them were basically off the table within the first couple of days. So, yeah, I am with the general sentiment that it is annoying to finally get Keisha back after all these years, only to lose her after nine days, whatever it was. But as is often pointed out in situations like this, that is so vastly preferable to just never having gotten to see Keisha again. And I'm guessing in Keisha's opinion, spending 10 days in the Big Brother house and being the first boot is well worth it for $40,000 or whatever the minimum stipend was. So yeah, I am certainly not happy to lose Keisha, I guess, this soon. She was someone I was hoping could make a deeper run here, and I thought she had at least a decent chance of being in there for a much longer time than we ended up seeing. But if there is someone who is going to go out in week one in unceremonious fashion, and it seems like their heart, debatably at least, was not as into it as the rest of the house, I am okay with it being Keisha compared to some of the other people that I've been waiting so long to see back. So, you know, we talked about you, or at least you said, it's difficult to get oneself cast on an all-star season based on things that are happening in week one. It's normally a much larger collective body of work that is getting people these return invites. Not so much the case, Dom, for one person here who made a solid enough impression, it seems, in one day to be brought back here for this all-star season. What, if anything, because we haven't unfortunately gotten to see too much of him yet, but what have you made of David to this point?
Nothing. And that's the problem. You kind of get the sense that it was very unfortunate for him to go out the way he did on day one. But honestly, it may have been the best thing in terms of his legacy, because he comes back in this season and so far has really done nothing to speak of. And I'm going to need him to pick that up soon if I'm going to think that his spot on the season wasn't completely wasted.
I'm certainly not at all ready to say it is in the running to be completely wasted as far as I'm concerned. I just know nothing about this guy, but I like what little I have gotten to see. I thought it was very cool that he got to vote first and everyone applauded for him. Maybe a little demeaning if you're David in that spot. You're like the one kid on the team who hasn't scored a basket yet, and so they put you in and like force feed you the ball. There could be some element of that, but I still think there is plenty of room for David to grow as both a player and a character in my eyes. And I continue, I think, to just be at basically neutral with David, but not at all, Dom. Like you coming in here saying David's got 5 minutes to make it up to me before I'm mad that this wasn't Braden from BB11.
I'm not saying that, but either like come back in and I would say change it up, but he doesn't have anything to change up yet. So just make an impression somehow, whether it's a good impression, bad impression. Kind of indifferent for me, but just make an impression, you know?
I disagree. I would say, David, plan A is go in that house and don't make an impression until two months from now.
I get that, and maybe that's smart. I do think towards the end, he will need to do big things in order to overcome the hump of being this unknown in a cast full of all-stars. But in terms of me as a TV viewer who cannot possibly be invested in David because he has not been on my TV before, give me something to work with. You know, I gotta get something to be invested in, or else it just isn't gonna happen.
I still think there is hopefully at least plenty to come from David under at least a reasonable number of circumstances there. So he would be another person. Oh my God, can you imagine if David went in there and cast the hinky vote? I would be in love with this guy.
It would be perfect. That would be a great way to introduce yourself to the BB fan base at large. But sadly, it was not to be.
Yes. All right. So, Dom, I talked earlier about Tyler potentially being a standout kind of steal of the draft candidate based on what I've seen through the first week here. He went for $7.50 to win 150. Someone who went for $5 to win 150 needs like 3.3% equity to win the game, to be breaking even here. And I feel like, again, not someone we've seen a ton of this first week, but I would at this point feel very good about them exceeding that 3.3% threshold. I have been very impressed with Davon, who has obviously been in the house before and had it go not so great her first two times. We talked in, I keep calling it a preview podcast, even though it took place after the season had begun. I brought up the idea of Davon potentially being a compelling candidate to have that kind of Tyson or Coach Wade on Survivor. Now that they're back for the third time, they've learned a lot and they're really going to be taking this seriously. What do you think about how Davon has been doing to this point? Is this another case where I'm just seeing exactly what I want to see?
So it feels like in a way it's the inverse of her original game in BB17, where that time she went out very early, but she had these incredible reads on the house. Like she clocked everyone straight away, but couldn't translate into traction in the game. This time around, it feels like her reads on the house are terrible. She doesn't really know what's going on, but she seems to be in good with a lot of people, and people will like her well enough, and it seems like she has a better future than she did in BB17. So she's playing like the exact opposite game from there, and it looks like it's going to work out better for her. not really qualified to compare it to her BB-18 game, which was kind of, you know, if she's set up for success this season and her first season she went down in flames, BB-18 was a lot more in between. For now, it seems like she's getting off to a good start. But again, I would say a high variance player in terms of you can turn on the feeds one morning and the house is just completely flipped on its head. And that's because either Davon engineered that and that's what she was trying to do, or she did something, you know, she made a mistake and that's why it's being flipped on against her now.
Yeah, Davon is one of the, frankly, many people in this cast who is just kind of outside of the big majority group that we saw like explicitly set up on the TV episode, where I get this sense that everyone is getting good vibes from Davon and she wouldn't be in any kind of immediate danger. But other than it seems like she and Bailey are pretty tight at this point. She is one of the people just outside of that big alliance that I want to like apologize to the listening audience for just not really knowing what's been going on with them.
Mm-hmm.
But based on just the brief strategic conversations I've gotten to see her have and the general interactions that I have observed, I would definitely be keeping an eye on Davon for sure as well thus far this season. And I guess let's move over to, it seems like her closest ally, although certainly any live feed viewers are welcome to correct me on this one. It seems like Bailey has been tight with Davon, another person that I just don't know enough about the details of her other relationships in the house to have a super strong take on, having not seen her original season. What have you made of Bailey to this point?
Bailey seems to be, maybe more than anyone else, like outperforming their first season so far. That might be unfair to the first part of her stint in BB20, where my understanding is she was playing very well until she wasn't, basically. It was, you know, she was in a great spot until things didn't go her way one week, and then she blew up with Tyler, and then she wasn't able to regain any footing in the house after that. This time around, she seems to be off to a great start. You know, no one sees her as a threat. People like her well enough. I think even if Bay and Day as a pair are being targeted, I think Davon has the reputation to be the bigger target first. If Day ends up going and then Bay's seen as being on her own, then that's a great spot to be in. And just in general, like she made up well with Tyler, has left the door open to working with him. So yeah, I think she's off to a great start. The one thing that Tyler did identify with her was that she actually is kind of very calm for the most part at first, but then when she feels comfortable with you, that's when she is kind of like more blunt, more direct, and maybe saying things that she shouldn't be. So I wonder if she's always going to be like the victim of her own success, where she gets to the point where she's done good work in the house and she feels comfortable because of it, and then that's where she gets, you know, she says the wrong things to the wrong person, or there's some drama in the house that she gets involved in as like collateral damage, and then that's what ends her game for her.
Yeah, I know very little, unfortunately, about Bailey still, and very little, meaning Bailey, like the person, or what to expect from her as a player within the game as things go forward. But certainly happy to have only invested $4 into Bailey to win $150 at this point. I am very optimistic about that being a good price based on what we know right now. The other person on my team here, Dom, the final human member of my team, along with my winning bid on not having a winner this season, having production shut down somewhere along the way, but the final actual person on my team, Nicole Anthony, who, again, both of us were unfortunately coming in essentially blind on this season, knowing she was like immensely popular after BB21. What do we think about Nicole to this point?
So I think the comment I saw about Nicole Anthony that sums her game up the best is she needs to be on the side of the underdog. And even when the door is open for her to be in a more secure spot, she always wants to be like she will always be one of the three people in that room with Ian and Kevin, right? It's always going to be Nicole Anthony. You can pencil her in plus X plus Y. I think that's an admirable quality to have in real life, where like you are putting out the hand of friendship to people who maybe don't always receive it. I don't think it's a good quality in the Big Brother house, where you need to be in power to make anything happen, and even if you can work your way to the end as an underdog, you maybe won't always be respected for it. So I don't think she's off to a great start. I think she has the tools to kind of like overcome that, but doesn't seem all that interested in using them.
I would say for the 50th time probably over the course of this podcast, I was not tuned into the live feeds 24/7 or whatever, but I certainly see some of it, and I definitely see plenty of live feed tweets just on my timeline. And if I were forced to choose a name of someone that it seemed like the consensus was they had kind of a disappointing week one, obviously other than Keisha, I feel like I saw quite a bit about Nicole Anthony not necessarily just having the right read on certain situations, or not being where she needed to be, or just things just generally not being off to a hot start for particularly Nicole A. And based on what I would imagine would be a kind of inherent desire for most of the people doing that kind of reporting to see the positive side of how things are going for Nicole, that leaves me pretty nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Dom, one other person here that we kind of touched on that I'd be curious to hear what you thought is Christmas. One of the lower value people in our auction draft, but it seems at least to me like she's fitting in well enough. They're not standing out as a big target right away. I don't know if that necessarily translates to a super meaningful amount of win equity, but are you at least okay enough with Christmas being on the season to this point?
I would say so. Yeah, I think she's come across as endearing on the feeds, although it feels like every time I turn the feeds on, it's always on Christmas. And if you want to get away, it's kind of hard to find other options. It's always like her talking to someone and then taking up 75% of the conversation at the same time. But in a pretty harmless way, as far as I can tell. And yeah, it seems like she has done a good enough job of getting in people's good books. Like, she has a thing with Tyler that I don't know if people are fully appreciating, but the two of them seem super tight. And I don't know if she will become a target now that she has hit them from the left side by using the safety thing on Ian, but good enough start from Christmas so far. But we didn't completely exhaust your list there, my friend. How are you feeling about the no-winner outcome at this point in the season?
Oh, I mean, did you not see the over-the-top safety precautions they're taking, making people, for like seemingly no reason beyond theater, put on masks when they go back outside the Big Brother house? I don't see how this could go wrong.
Right. I was almost angry at the people who were tweeting snippily about like Julie not wearing a mask or whatever, because like, where is the danger meant to be in this situation, right? Like, it's they understand what the precautions are here, and if there's any place that's going to be safe, a gigantic soundstage with literally no other people in it is probably as safe as you're going to be for any kind of indoor location. And Julie does also have to talk; that is her job. Even if some of the things she's saying are cryptic at best, or just like downright hypocritical and offensive at worst, like, let's see how Les Moonves is implementing the Confucian idea of treating people how you want to be treated. But either way, I think the prospect of the season just going down in flames thanks to COVID at this point, it's hard to rule any differently than we did when we were debating that during the draft. But I guess cautiously optimistic at this point.
I am, yes, definitely happy with what I have seen to this point, although I'm not even sure what would have made me nervous necessarily. I feel okay about the prospect of this season being able to play all the way through to completion. That being said, prize pool up for grabs, $150. I got no winner for $13, meaning I need like high single digits. I'm not capable of that kind of math live on air of equity for this season to get shut down. I still feel good about that price. I still feel like we have at least a 10% chance of COVID taking this one down.
Okay. So let's move on to Kaz's roster then, including someone who was in the discussion to be a nominee in the first week, who seemed destined to be a nominee this week once Memphis won HOH, but Christmas out of nowhere with the assist, swooping down like his guardian angel to lift him up off the block here. And that's a friend of the podcast, Ian Terry, who what are you making of his performance in there so far?
First thing that has to be said is, you know, I talked about getting to watch these live feeds being perhaps, actually, I guess I didn't talk about it in this podcast. I talked about this on the last Patreon podcast we did, and then I asked you about it on this podcast, but I will now share publicly that as far as I have been concerned, watching this first week of feeds may be the literal highlight for me in terms of Big Brother fan experience. It's certainly close, but it's definitely either this week or the very end game of BB14 was such a treat to be able to watch and cover in real time. And a huge piece of that obviously has to do with Ian being back in there. I know that this cast on the whole is incredible and far, far better than I ever would have anticipated. But when I stopped watching Big Brother several years ago at this point, I've always thought to myself, if Ian's ever back in there, I don't care who else is in there, I'll watch for as long as Ian is there. And having on night one the Dolphin Crash shirt make its debut literally night one of this season was the single highlight for me as a Big Brother. I thought that was so fun, having Ian in there, getting to live all of this out again, and this time essentially playing with house, I mean literally playing with $500,000 worth of house money, getting to attempt to run it back. And it seems to me, just have a as fun of a time as he can while he's in there. It did seem like potentially there was a time that his name was being floated around as a potential nominee during week one. I was ecstatic to see early reports that the veto was likely not going to be used, and I wasn't going to have to sweat that at all. And then when Memphis won the week two HOH, I thought that was just about the worst thing Ian could have asked for, and I was very nervous about that being a dangerous prospect. But, you know, moments before we came on to start recording, seeing Ian was given the safety by Christmas, my spirits are back up, Dom. It's a Christmas miracle, to repeat another one of my Smash tweets. You can follow me at Colin Stone if you would like to expedite this process and not listen to our future podcasts. But I don't know if this is what I would describe as the best start Ian necessarily could have gotten off to, but I do think obviously being safe this week is huge for him. I'm hoping HOH can fall into some slightly better hands, potentially his own, next week, and still at this hour feeling at least reasonably good about Ian's position in the house, the bonds he's been able to build with most people other than, it seems, the person who won HOH this week, as far as I can tell. And moreover, just endlessly excited about the prospect of getting to continue to watch Ian here for quite a while. It does seem like he at least has a decent chance of going deep.
And his wardrobe did not stop with the Dolphin Crash t-shirt, which, yes, incidentally, it was fun to see the Zach Severzewski, however you pronounce it himself, emerging from the woodwork after so many years to say he was as gobsmacked as anyone else to see the Dolphin Crash logo back on Big Brother, because he shot that thing down in 2009. You know, that was when the last order was placed for a Dolphin Crash t-shirt, until Ian decided to bring it back from the dead as an homage. And I have to wonder what Dani DiNardo was thinking when she saw the Dolphin Crash t-shirt on on Ian's small frame. But she was even more confused, as it turned out, because I turned on the feeds one time to hear her say, "Did his t-shirt say Duck in Pumpkin?" And I just pumped a fist so hard. That to me, I remember the fallout from Dan's funeral in BB14, and that moment right there as the two happiest moments I can remember watching the feed. Just like, oh my god, he actually did it. He snuck it past the censors. He got the G1 fucking pumpkin t-shirt on the show in some form. So really excited to see what else he has in store. If the patented Sangmin bathrobe is going to make an appearance at some point, or really what else is lurking in Ian's bag of tricks there.
I am very, very excited. I'm also thrilled for him that it didn't take too long for them to give him a backgammon set, and now many people in the house have learned the rules and are loving it, as expected. But Ian was one of the people on have not restrictions this week, and I do wonder if, because it was so brutal on them, that's why they gave him the backyard instead.
And gave him the backyard as well. Like, when he was cooped up inside with the rest of them, he was not taking that well. He was really going through some tough times for the first few days. And Ian, in the game so far, has been really up and down, where it seemed like he was an early outcast, and then a few days later, it was like, oh my god, everyone in the house is saying how much they love Ian and want to work with Ian. Maybe he actually is just going to run this thing back from the outset. And then also, a few days later, it was back to, I don't know if we can trust Ian, he's a little sketchy, so on and so forth. He has this really tight alliance with Nicole Franzel, which I think makes a lot of sense for both of them. We already see her holding up that end of the bargain, convincing Christmas, it sounds like, to put herself out there on Ian's behalf. Don't know if he has really any other secure allies to speak of, and he'll have to find a way either to worm his way into that Cody block, or wait for that Cody block to disintegrate and start attacking each other, at which point no one's going to be coming after Ian anymore. So I think he might just need to make it through the next few rounds, and then he might be golden, but that could be easier said than done. I don't know.
That is exactly what I think at this point. There are definitely people in there who recognize that Ian, if left alone, is potentially going to have a real chance of kind of sneaking through and showing up in the end game with a reasonable chance of winning. And I do think it is kind of a big swing for him how these next couple of HOH competitions go, if he can make it through kind of undetected and not have to deal with Memphis and Cody, particularly like bouncing back and forth. Although it does seem like Nicole F has thankfully been doing a good job kind of keeping him safe with the two of them. I am very optimistic that he, if left alone, can do some real damage there. I am concerned that may not be as likely this time around as it was his first time around, but I love, love, love seeing that once the backyard was finally open, I watched, I was checking in and out of the live feeds for most of that day, and what I saw from Ian Terry was him out in the hammock or out in the pool by himself. If people come up and talk to me, awesome, I'm happy to engage, but otherwise, I'll just be out here chilling. No one has anything to worry about. If you need me, you know where to find me. And that's the end of the story for Ian Terry. I feel like that is definitely the approach I would hope to see him taking at this point. And I am optimistic that he will continue to have roughly the right set of priorities here. So, yeah, very excited about what could potentially be left to come here for Ian. I know we came in here talking about him as one of potentially the front runners, and I don't know if that is necessarily the case based on what we've seen through week one, but it's still extremely positive overall about what I have seen and what I expect to see going forward.
I don't know if they gave the hammock some extra grease this season, but as far as I know, there is no squeaking in sight. No one complaining about that just yet. And I kind of hope that Ian does win an early HOH so that he can remain in his hammock, just like receiving people like some kind of mafia kingpin, as they, you know, he'll be taking audiences there in his hammock. That's where the real seat of power is in the Big Brother house.
Do we know what his punishment costume is yet?
No, but I'm sure he's incredibly excited to be donning that for the rest of the week.
Yes, Dom.
Well, let's stay on Ian quickly, because our kind of teachable moment of week one of the Big Brother All-Stars was Ian opening up to, I think it was Kesa and Enzo who were like in the room at the time, and maybe Nicole Anthony too, about being autistic. And the clip of that was shown on one of the recent episodes, and Ian prefaced that by saying he doesn't want this to be his identity, his story in the house. And so I saw some backlash towards CBS for even just airing that in the first place, which I don't think is justified. I think if this is all that you see of Ian on this season, like he just vanishes into the ether and becomes Purple Ian, then that would be a valid criticism. Or if they keep going back to this theme after Ian has explicitly made clear like he doesn't want that to happen, then that would be fair enough. But just as a segment that both humanizes Ian and other people in his spot, and also is kind of bringing that to a wide audience, I think that's perfectly fine. And I think, you know, of course you show that, like that's the kind of clip that you want to show. It is interesting seeing like the first order and second order reactions to that, though. Like, for example, you had Kesa opening back up to Ian about how he's in the same boat. And neither of them have been officially, like, formally diagnosed, but Casey said that he has struggled with a lot of the same things, and that he feels the label applies to him too, and that he really values Ian trusting him with that information, and that he's going to go out of his way to, like, look out for Ian insofar as he can within the game. And a lot of people saying that that was manipulative on Case's side, and then, like, the backlash towards those people, firstly for just saying anything bad about Case, but then also insinuating that he would ever be as, like, cruel or heartless as to do that, which, I don't know, I feel like just the aspects of your personality that come into play in a social game are all of them, basically, and if this is something that Ian struggles with or that he lives with inside the house, and we saw this in BB14 too, then of course that comes into play, and someone who is self-aware to the extent that Ian is will know how to leverage that to his advantage if he wants to. I don't think that's what he was doing in the first week, right? He did seem genuinely very anxious and out of place, and he said to, I think it was Nicole Anthony, that this was the worst he'd felt across 70-something days in Big Brother, including all of his first season when so much shit was being heaped upon him by, like, Frank and Boogie and so on. Like, just feeling the way he did in the first week was the worst he'd felt. So clearly, like, that was sincere. That wasn't being played up for anything. But it wouldn't surprise me if down the line it works at Ian's advantage, and he knows it, that people see him as, like, harmless or socially awkward or whatever it is that they think, because, you know, when you're listing threats that you want to take out with your HOH week, Ian is then less of a target. I think that's a perfectly valid observation to make. I do question how much Case actually relates to it, though, because I think there are two aspects to this. There's, like, the interior experience of what Case feels about himself and what he's gone through, which, I mean, neither I nor anyone else can tell him what that is. That's only he can know that and decide what labels to apply to it. But then there is also how other people treat you because of it. And I think if you, first of all, just said, who in the Big Brother house do you think either has been diagnosed with autism or meets some of the typical traits that you would associate with that, I think the vast majority of people would say Ian, and I don't think anybody at all would say Kesa. And so that naturally feeds into how they respectively are treated differently by people. And so, yeah, I think it is fair to point out that there are differences, like severe differences, between how Ian views the world and Kesa views and experiences the world, and that's fine. And I don't think Kesa was being malign and trying to, like, relate to Ian on that level, but you see Nicole Anthony kind of take that to the extreme, where she says, oh, well, at the end of the day, we're all just on the spectrum, and she means well, clearly, but that's not really how it works, I don't think. Like, there are clearly specifics going on there. And then even in the clinical sense in which that's often used, like, it's not like you have the normies on one end and people like Ian on the other end, and that's what the spectrum consists of. It's you have people who have autism and people who don't, and then on the autistic spectrum, it's high-functioning autism on one end, and then the kind of low-functioning developmental problems on the other end, and that's how the spectrum is usually drawn up, which in itself is, like, very dubious and very questionable, and as far as I can tell has no real basis in actual scientific fact, but there you go, that's just how it's used. But it is worth noting where, like, Nicole's bringing up this idea, and it clearly is meaning well in doing it, but her misconception is also about a misconception, if that makes sense. So, like, it's kind of, like, nested on top of each other. It was heartwarming to see, like, even not a stereotype like Enzo or whatever, but people like Enzo really being gracious to Ian and, like, receptive towards him and not just, like, dismissing him out of hand the way that the Franks and Boogies of the world have been known to do in their time.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was certainly an interesting conversation between Kacer and Ian. I promise you, Ian was aware that it was being filmed and could potentially be shown on TV. And as I, you know, I was watching that conversation when it was happening, and to kind of echo, it seemed, Ian's thoughts as all that was going down is, I don't think we need to spend forever on this. This isn't that big of a deal, but I definitely did think it was totally fair, obviously, of the show to put that on air. And my big take when it did come up on the TV episode was, this seems very good, as far as I'm concerned, for the producers, for whatever reason, to feel compelled to flag up Ian for some totally non-game related thing and make the audience feel better about him. I think this can only be good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I have gathered through, as far as I have been concerned, we've at least touched on everyone. I am going to offer you this final opportunity because I contextually have some I wonder if you may have thoughts on others that you would like to add that we didn't get to this point. But what if anything, would you like to throw out there while we're still here for wrapping up week one?
I guess just a final thought on the Ian thing. I think it plays into this wider theme that I've seen this week of people like really infantilizing Ian and just treating him like, oh, he's my poor sweet baby who's just like so innocent and so naive and needs to be protected at all costs. And then some of those people at the same time are also talking about how big a crush they have on Ian, which is like, you can have one or the other, but having both at the same time feels a little dodgy to me. It's like how I know it's treating Ian like he's some kind of like anime girl or something. Like, it's just, I don't know, it feels weirdly infantilizing.
It's coming from many people, at least. Like, Ian has it together to such a ludicrous extent beyond the people who are commenting on this.
Well, not just that, it's that some of these people should know better because they have met Ian before. Or, like, you can get a sense of what Ian's truly like, and believe me, there is more of an edge to him than the people treating him like he's some kindergartner who got lost and wandered onto the Big Brother set. Like, that is not who Ian is, let me tell you.
Yes. I got the sense, Dom, in watching that HOH comp last night, that Ian was indeed very mad at himself for missing his whatever question he went out on, especially considering it was a memory competition where I'm guessing he had pretty high expectations for himself. I know just from talking to Ian over the years that he is a believer at the very least in the value in modern Big Brother of winning, particularly the week one HOH, but I think just early HOH weeks in general, he sees a lot more merit in going for than potentially we were propagating to our listeners for so many years back when we were covering this show regularly. Would you be enthusiastically encouraging Ian to go out there and get the next HOH he can? Do you think that would be a good thing for his game?
It might be that if he makes it through this week, which we now know he will, then he won't need to nearly as much. And you know, it was only Memphis in like the worst case scenario winning that that put him in that bind. I think Ian, he's not going to have, like we saw Tyler say, I'm going to try and win every single competition. I don't know if Tyler even believes that himself, but Ian is not the type to buy into any like ideology like that. If it makes sense for Ian to throw a comp, he'll throw a comp. If it makes sense for him to try to win, he'll try to win. It seemed like he was genuinely frustrated about missing that question. I think Ian would love to be in a position where he can get to throw the head of household if he wants to. You know, that's a sign that things are going okay. He's not in any immediate danger. But if if it seems like that's changing, then you know he'll turn it on and bring that competition game that turned out to be so clutch in BB14.
Yes. All right. So, anyone else that you had any other week one takes that you wanted to put out there?
Not especially. It does seem like this second week is going to kind of continue in the same vein as the first, where it looks like maybe David and Nicole Anthony are going up, or Kevin once again and Nicole Anthony are going up, and we're going to see someone in that kind of like outcast group get evicted. And that's not going to get this season off to the start that that most people want to see it off to. But remember, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And if there is a house which can overturn itself because people are self-interested and looking to make moves and looking to improve their own position, then it is this one, in recent memory. So even if the season itself, like the gameplay, is off to a bad start, and even if some of the challenges or the production choices are baffling and leave you scratching your head, then never fear, keep the faith, Colin. That's what we always say. Keep hope alive.
Yes, and I mean, thinking back to BB7, our original All-Star season, BB7 spoilers incoming, Allison and Nokomis, I would have said, were two of the last people I would have wanted to see be the first two gone. But in the context of that, it felt almost underwhelming. And obviously, the season was able to carry on quite nicely, even despite losing such kind of heavy hitters early. So while this is not necessarily the kind of fireworks spectacle I was potentially hoping we may already be in store for by this point in the game, there is so much time left, and we are just getting started. And who knows, Dom, if we are just getting started here on our podcast coverage or if this will be the penultimate one, but I am in for at least coming back here next week.
Absolutely. I wonder if there's some kind of comparisons we made between Keisha this season and Diane in the first All-Stars, where if you said going into that season Diane is going to be out early, you'd think, oh, well, that's a bummer. Maybe the season's going to be less exciting now. By the time that Diane was actually evicted, nobody was saying that anymore. And that in its own right was disappointing. But given that that was the case, it was not too sad to see her go.
Yes, I think that is an apt parallel there. So, all right, I think that is going to do it for us here on week one of BB22. Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. I can be found on there at Colin Stone. And as has been mentioned earlier, we do weekly, not quite weekly, but a few times a month, bonus episodes over at patreon.com/DomandColin, currently going through BB8. We also have all of BB10 up there, all of BB7 up there, many Survivor seasons, including Heroes versus Villains, just did China. So if you're a Big Brother person who's kind of new to this and you would be interested in more, that would be the place to go. But until we are back in here after we have seen how week two plays out, I think that is going to do it for us. So thank you guys for making it this far. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.
All right. I can probably put that up tonight.
Okay, awesome. I can send you the audio.
Yeah, sick.